This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This has to be one of the most privileged positions in Scotland. We're 660 feet above the River Forth. We're looking across the Rosyth Naval Dockyard. You can see Longannet in the distance. There's Grangemouth Refinery. Basically, we're on the top of the world here.
We're on the top of the new Forth Crossing. How good is that?
It's brilliant. Absolutely superb. And the reason is because in this edition of Out of Doors, and by the way, I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, what we're going to be doing is following the route of the Forth all the way down from where it begins to where we're standing now, essentially.
And that gradual change from Rob Roy romantic countryside to something very different.
This is basically the story of the industrialisation of Scotland, and it's not just about how Scotland was industrialised, it's also about how the sort of natural heritage of Scotland has adapted to cope with it, how the people have adapted to cope with it. We're going to start right up the other side of Aberfoyle at Lockard, and it is up there, or just not terribly far away from there, that the River Forth, probably one of Scotland's most important rivers, begins. This is absolutely idyllic. I've never been out in this loch before. This is Lockard. It is mirror calm, surrounded by trees that are just beginning to turn for autumn. The hills are above all that. It's just superb. We've got Jim Gregg in the boat behind me. You're from the sort of local outdoor centre, etc. It's a real playground for the central belt, this entire area.
This is a kind of quiet loch, they like to call this. Maximum 5 horsepower. Uh-huh. It's for canoeing, for sailing. It's a quiet loch, and it's best, you know, it's beautiful. Here in front is one of the Rob Roy MacGregor's cave where they had for the English and the rock formation here.
There's several clefts.
Yeah.
And it could be any of them, basically.
Yeah. So which one is it?
I think it's...
Just make it up, Jim. We'll believe him.
No. Let me see. I think it's this one here in the corner.
Okay, that big one.
Yeah.
Just explain this. We're actually in two canoes at the moment.
We're rafted up. What could go wrong?
And Mark's not paddling any of them. Concentrating on his art.
Yeah. It is worth pointing out that Ewan's chances of survival of this trip have been greatly enhanced by the fact that these are Canadian canoes, so they're open. Therefore, if it does tip, which is highly unlikely, you'll just fall out this time.
Because the last experience on Canna, I got stuck upside down in a cave in a sea kayak, and I swore I'd never go in a canoe again.
Yeah.
So these, they're a bit more solid, though, Jim.
These are centre boats, wider, nearly 4 foot across. So these are especially for beginners.
That's our kind of canoe.
That's our kind of canoe.
I can't see a cave, though.
No, I think it's in here, in the gap in here.
There we go. Now, this is interesting, because it's kind of like a rock step.
You know, what's happening now is Mark's on the inside canoe, and Jim's just leapt up like a gazelle. Into the cliff face. He's disappeared as far as I can see.
Can't see him. I'm trying to manipulate two canoes at the same time.
I don't know how you manage.
No help whatsoever.
At least you're not moaning about it.
That's true. This is a bit like climbing up a green throat to a certain extent. Very, very mossy, very slippy. And there's the cave.
Yeah.
So basically, the rock is separated, gone towards the loch, and left this gap behind. It doesn't look terribly comfortable.
It's not. Once you go down and you go in, there's room for like one person. It's only a bolt hole, seemingly, where you could actually see the drover's path, the other side of the loch, and make your escape for there with the redcoats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The water in the loch itself is almost completely black. It's very, very peaty.
Yeah, very, very deep, very, very cold. It's 4 miles long. Deepest part of the loch's about 120 foot deep. We have got a lot of fish, as you can see, jumping just now.
Yeah.
We've got maybe, they reckon, 6 crannogs in Loch Ard. One still clearly visible. We've got the major island, Elangorn, the Green Island. It was a Covenanters island where they had the church in Ireland, and where they had to pray in secret. There was actually a physical church until the Victorians came onto the loch, and then demolished the church, built a bothy, so they could have a dram. Yeah. Well, the dogs were out getting the ducks that were shooting in the loch that day.
Yeah.
So I'm slightly distracted. Wait, I've no idea where he is. Where are you?
I'm holding the boat.
Oh, right. OK, fair enough. Right. Discretion's the better part of valour, obviously.
Yeah.
So we're coming down to the entrance to the Narrows now.
Yeah.
We've said it probably about 5 times already in the first 5 minutes. It's idyllic. It's just fantastic. Beautiful.
And it's interesting because you automatically talk quietly because it's just so peaceful.
Yeah.
You know? Your voices aren't raised. Now, I know you've got a bad record with this, but that looks to me like a rock, so you maybe want to avoid that bit.
Well, it's a school of mountain biking, is it? If you look at the rock long enough, you will hit it.
that rock we'll probably have found was a crannog.
All right, okay.
Yeah, there's 6 of them on the loch. Uh-huh. There's one complete at the top end of the loch, and there's other, it's just the boulders.
Let's go look at a crannog, man.
Yeah.
Jim said these things were difficult to tip. He didn't say they were impossible to tip.
Okay.
Off you go. Have fun.
Oh, you can see it, look.
No. Oh,
wow.
Yeah, you see the shelf.
We might as well hit this. We're going right over the top of this crannog now. Big boulders.
I'm not liking that sound. Up at the SV hole.
What's that sound?
That's the sound of you grounding the boat.
It was a means of defending a dwelling place. You actually built out onto the loch so you would have a walkway with pilings out, you know, so you'd be above the surface of the water. And then one big, enormous hut, usually built onto a pile of stones like this. So very often the only evidence you have of a crannog in a loch is the pile of stones.
Because it's really deep there, and it's like an underwater island, if that makes any sense at all.
Uh-huh.
And it suddenly gets shallow again, as you can see, because we're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, you're stuck, I'm fine. Look, see?
Yeah. Yeah. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. There's only a couple of boulders. But they kept the cattle underneath the crannogs and they slept above the cattle because this is Rob Roy country. And Rob Roy, as Fort Lord says, was a splendid guy. But in reality, he was just
a
cattle thief. And so when people used to at night bring their cattle in, just so because cattle was more valuable than human life then.
No. I got slightly distracted while you were speaking there because a dragonfly came down, looking like a sort of, you know, primordial helicopter, landed on my hat, which is on the seat in front, and then went off again.
Why, we're seeing some sights. Catch them now.
No, you're not.
Yeah, we will.
Yes, you will.
What we're in at the moment now is like a sort of natural canal to a certain extent. It is so quiet here that when there was a slight pause, I heard one of these rhododendron leaves fall off the shrub and hit the water. You know, it's not often I doubt your word.
Seriously, I did.
Right. It's an overused phrase, magical.
Always the one that you broke first there.
But, you know, we're holding the two boats together, basically with one hand, you know, and it's just taking us downstream.
It's my kind of canoeing.
Absolutely.
It's early days yet.
Kind of hijacked two folk, two folk and a dog, it would appear. Just canoeing up in the opposite direction. Who are you?
Gordon McClure and my daughter Heather.
Excellent. What's the dog called?
Dash.
Now, you wouldn't have thought there was room in a canoe for a dog. He's a sizeable chunk of dog.
Yes, he's a Lurcher Cross, but he's 15. He's an old boy and he's used to this.
Do you lot come out canoeing on a regular basis?
Yes, yes. We live locally to here, so I'm up here quite regularly. Go all over Scotland, though.
What strikes me here is how quiet it is, how peaceful it is. This is very, very gentle canoeing.
Yes, this is very relaxing.
So how often do you get out?
Not often enough, to be honest. Just depends on the weather. My daughter, Heather, she lives in London, so she's just up for the weekend. So.
And you dragged her out canoeing?
No, she volunteered.
I did, indeed.
So do you miss it?
I really do, yeah. Yeah, not many opportunities down south.
Because it's a bit of a contrast. Our programme's all about contrast. We're going... start at the top of the Forth, going right down to the heart of industrial Scotland along the river, and this is just supremely tranquil.
I've done various sections of it. I've done from Callander down the Forth right down to the motorway at Dobies, and I've done different sections of the Forth at different times. It's a long way. You've got a long journey ahead of you. The next wee locking down is one of the most photographed, as I said to Heather, one of the most photographed calendar, Scottish calendar places you'll see in on the left-hand side, the wee boathouses, and you'll recognise it from Scottish calendars. It's very, very picturesque.
Not happy not, we'll let you back.
Nice to meet you.
Goodbye.
So chilled out. Well, we've not been paddling too hard, but we're way ahead of Mark, and I've just turned the boat round and I can see why. Oh, he's actually put a paddle in his hand for the first time. Jim's been driving the whole thing and Mark's been telling him tales of travels round Scotland. Oh, there's Jim throwing himself over the side.
I tell you what I'm not getting.
What? Where's this calendar boathouse thing?
I don't know.
See where the white house is?
Right,
we're going to go round the corner to the right, and then it'll open another small bay, and that's where the Avon Dhu, the first river section, starts. And then it goes into the Forth. So when you go round the corner, you'll see it's like Scandinavian hothouses on the lock and things like that, wee sheds, saunas and all that stuff.
Jim was just saying that they get mallard on this lock, but they don't get coots, they don't get swans. I wonder why that is.
It's mainly the temperature at night that drives them, because coots are very temperature sensitive. Huh? And if it goes below zero... then they won't come up here.
Okay. All right. He's made that up again.
Make that up.
Yeah, of course he made it up.
It sounded quite plausible.
It always does.
I'll use that one too. I'm on an awful lot today.
Noise pollution.
Ah. Go like that. We've paddled from Upper Lockhart down through Lower Lockhart, and we're facing another entry there, which is essentially the river, which will take us down onto the Forth. And obviously other folk have had the same idea back in Victorian times and have built these lovely mansions around about the place, and there's lots of boathouses and things. Very posh. Quite the job.
And a lot of people will have seen this.
How come?
Calendars.
Because this is one of the most photographic areas in Lockhart. If you look straight through the gap, you'll see Ben Lomond at the back, just and through the clouds. So when it's misty, there's a wee bit of mist in the lock, and you've got the lovely house, the boathouses. If you look straight up, it looks absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
You know, with the pine and, you know, it's Norwegian spruce, I think, you know.
There is an amazing, I presume this is all Victorian planting, an amazing array of species of trees.
Right now, we've just came to the end of Lockhart, we're at the bottom section, and we're just entering the river section of the Avon Dhu.
So this is the River Forth, just ahead of us?
No, this is the, just ahead of us. So the Avon Dhu runs through the lock, drops down under the bridge, joins the Dukery Water, and that's where you get the Forth.
And we can't go any further because there's a fence.
No,
because
somebody has put a fence across the river.
Yeah.
Why would you?
I've never seen that before.
Why would you do that?
I know. It's Lockhart, it's just how it is.
As we came in, the reflection was just incredible. It was like paddling through a watercolour. Yeah. Stunning.
You said earlier up, when we were paddling through, to a certain extent, a lot of this is almost like going through the sort of chalk streams of England.
Yeah.
And it has that feel about it. It's so gentle, it's so relaxed, it's sort of peaceful.
Slightly boggy bit here, but effectively, Jim, this is the confluence of the river.
This is it. This is us here. The Avon Dhu coming on the right-hand side, Dookery Water coming from the back, and this here is now the fourth.
So the two combined, we are absolutely the headwaters
this
of the fourth
here. This is us here right now. Okay.
It's quite exciting, isn't it? I think
you wouldn't recognise it unless somebody told you. That's the point. Yeah. Yeah, it's not as if they put signs up saying this is where the river starts.
No, it's just that lovely sense of, you know, this is going to become that massive big estuary. Yeah. And we've got quite an exciting journey ahead of us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been great so far. It's been fantastic. There's nothing to indicate the fact that this bridge is actually the first bridge across the Forth. This is at the headwaters, essentially.
You would have thought it would be a wee plaque or something, wouldn't you?
Something of the kind. I mean, the water coming down from Loch Ard is still black. Because it's autumn time, the leaves are floating on the surface of it, so you're getting these sort of speckles of green through it. It's a fantastic backdrop. I mean, that cliff face is astonishing.
It's terrific, and it's really, really busy, isn't it?
Kind of got run down there.
Yeah, we're falling. So absolutely coaching with people. But over here, we've got an interesting story. We got quite excited about it when we heard about it.
Well, the idea is that Bailey Nicol Jarvie rode in here with a couple of friends that were trying to recover.
Kind of flamboyant kind of
magistrate,
yeah.
That's it, you know. And everybody loves Glasgow lawyers. So he turns up here with two pals. They're trying to recover the family fortune of one of them. And they get to the inn.
This is the inn in front of us. It's flats now, but...
Well, across the door, there's a stripped hazel wand, which is an old Highland signal for do not disturb, but they ignore that. They go in.
Pardon, I'm a magistrate.
I'm a magistrate of my way. And the inevitable happens. This Barney starts, and a Highlander who takes offence at this draws his sword. Bailey Nicol tries to draw his sword, but it's been so long since it's seen any service that it's actually rusted into the scabbard. So with tremendous presence of mind...
He grabbed the first thing handy.
Yeah, which was a red-hot poker out of the fire. And allegedly, you know, with his first thrust, he managed to set the plaid on fire, which seems just a tad...
I swear enough, you've got a
get out
you got
of
a plaid and a red-hot poker.
Yeah, it's a Highlander, he's bound to be damp. You know, you never catch fire in a month of Sundays.
Oh, I'm not totally convinced about that.
Anyway, the story caught the public imagination to the extent that they hung the poker in a tree. And it's supposed to be around here somewhere, but I don't know where it is. It's an oak tree surrounded by a metal fence across from the inn. Aha! Now look, see, it's overgrown. There's Roseberry Willow herb around the bottom of it. It's fenced off, but where's the poker?
Sometimes our luck is just so exciting. I've just knocked on the correct door.
Really?
I banged on the window and this woman said, come in, come in. Jackie, we were looking up there and you could see us looking bemused. Where's the poker gone?
Well, it fell down one windy night.
You're kidding.
Have you got it?
Well, yes.
Can we
can we
yes.
see it?
Yeah,
you
of course
you
can.
Well, there's no of course about it. No sensible individual will let us into there.
Oh. And that's not a poker at all, is it?
No. I think it's a bit of a...
It's a ploughshare.
It's a plough, yeah. And that's what he picked up and was having a good ding at the Highlander with.
Goodness me.
Supposedly, yes.
Supposedly. Right, okay. Wow. I'm very impressed by that.
That's superb.
We've been casting about since we left Aberfoyle because one of our listeners suggested we go and find the Lima Hamish swimming pool, which is, we know, near the top of the Forth, but we weren't terribly certain where. Somebody said it was around the back of the Rob Roy Hotel. Tom, you work here. Where is it?
Over there, 400 yards straight ahead.
Okay.
Can't miss it.
Can't miss it.
You want a bit?
So is it a good pool?
Oh, aye. I wonder, are you?
Yeah, okay, great.
Have you swum in it yourself, or have you fished it?
I fished it.
I love the ready athleticism with which McElwraith climbs the gate and we just open it.
What were you fishing for?
Salmon and sea trout. Well, the run itself, the Lima Hamish run, is good for the game fish.
So have you had any success?
Oh, aye. I had some very good ones.
What's your best one?
27 pound salmon.
That's good.
Right.
How long ago was that?
Oh, it's the best part of 40 years ago.
So do many people come here to swim the pool?
The locals did, but I don't think anywhere near as many now. Mm-hmm. Maybe some from the caravan site, Cobbleland. That's just along the edge of the river there a wee bit.
It's a very placid bit of river, isn't it?
Oh, a beautiful bit of river this.
Yeah.
But that's the pool itself there.
Good. That's where that fallen tree is.
Yep.
It's taking a turn for the bizarre at the moment, because Mark is semi-naked.
Well,
the squeaking noises in the background are
is a joints.
Is a wetsuit being forced onto a reluctant body.
Absolutely.
Should meet you zip you up?
Oh yeah, if you wouldn't mind.
Success.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just in the mud.
Not quite the plunging I was expecting.
What, were you expecting something more dramatic? Yeah. Why?
Something that makes a splash.
No. I want to check how deep it is for a start. There's no point jumping in and then bouncing off the bottom.
Oh,
that's cold in your feet, I'm telling you.
Oh, that's actually very nice.
What's amazing is, you know, the river's risen by at least 6 inches. It's quite envious, actually. That's looking quite good. What's incredible is Mark, he's swimming properly, so he's only 6 inches below the surface of the water. But it is so dark and so peaty and so inky, he just completely disappears.
Oh, the water's seeping down.
Ha!
But you'll be able to take your own little bit of the River Forth home with you.
Yeah. Are you sure you zipped this up at the back?
Not totally.
No, obviously not.
Yeah. Man.
No, I'm alright.
Sure?
Thanks. It's just, it'd be too much of a temptation to flip you in.
Well done. How was that?
That was alright, actually. It's actually quite invigorating.
But it's lovely, though. I mean, here we are, we're still the very early stages of this journey, and we've a fantastic canoe trip.
Yeah.
We found the missing poker.
Absolutely.
And we found another gentleman who's taken us to this secret little pool, because you would not know this was here. Yeah. There's no signs, there's nothing. This is 100% local knowledge, and it's lovely.
Yeah. No. And again, such a good idea doing the programme this way. Picking a route, whacking it up on Facebook and saying, any ideas what we could see on this route? And we've got so many ideas, we're never going to fit this into one programme. Not a hope.
Okay, onwards and downwards.
Yeah, I think I'll get changed if you don't mind. I dried out after the swimming pool and we've made our way across through Thornhill. And just before you get to Thornhill, essentially, the Castle Stirling opens out in front of you. There's this really wide valley, very, very fertile.
It just looks like the kind of prairies of the States, doesn't it? There's barley everywhere, as far as you can see, and really, really flat.
Well, we've turned off the road, and you know, now just to the south of us is where the River Forth is, but Dave Pickett is the reserve manager here at Flanders Moss. Explain what this totem pole's about.
This pole shows how deep the peat was in the place where we're standing. So it's about 6-7 metres high. Mm-hmm. And at places the peat was that deep in the whole area behind us, between us going down towards the river. But that peat was cleared away in a time period between 1750 and about 1860 because it was a wasteful product. It was in the way of people farming this good cast ground.
I mean, you say that, you know, farmers, landowners, etc., were clearing off the peat. I mean, physically digging out the peat and doing what with it?
Well, it was in the way. It was a waste product for some of them. So they were prepared to invest a lot of money to just get shot of it. And so what they did was they worked out all sorts of engineering ways of damming up water. Mm-hmm. And so that you then cut the peat, put it into ditches, and then let the water go, and it flushed the peat down into the River Forth and into the Forth estuary.
And you know, how much were they actually clearing? Give me an example.
An example. One of the landowners here recorded clearing about 11 acres of land of 2 metres of peat. That's about 4 hectares. And that was about 80,000 cubic metres of peat. The whole landscape must have looked different, and the people. I mean, they were stained black. If they were cutting peat all the time, you'd end up staining your skin black. You lived in houses that were made from peat turves stacked up. The smoke from the burning peat would have been rolling across the landscape at certain times of the year. So, you know, we're looking at a lovely pastoral landscape here, but it would have looked completely different 150 years ago.
Is there any way we can get an overview of the entire bog at the moment?
Absolutely. If we go up the path here, we've got a nice viewing tower to give you a look right across the moss.
Interesting picture of all these peat-stained people.
Well, and the fact that, you know, what we see as a pastoral scene at the moment, again, is this business about it's an industrial landscape, essentially. But I just can't get over the waste of actually not using the peat as fuel, but instead flushing that amount of organic material straight into the river. It must have clogged further downstream.
Well, there were complaints, big complaints from the salmon fishers, but what was I found interesting was that actually further down the Forth estuary, you know, what's one man's waste is another man's fuel, and people would rake out the peat from the estuary, dry it out, and use it as a fuel. So it didn't all go to waste.
Yeah.
And we are instantly going up, I don't know, 5 metres higher than we were a couple of steps ago.
We've come up onto the Dome of the Peat. I mean, we're on a nice aggregate path here, but if we stepped off the path, we'd be on what's really a gigantic blancmange. We're on this great wobbly lump of peat.
Right, let's coordinate, OK? On the count of three, we jump up and down, right? One, two, three. There are trees, little shrub birch, and they must be about 20 feet away, and they're actually shaking with it. No. Okay. Right, on the count of three. Do it again. On the count of three. One, two, three.
It's like being on a mattress. The whole thing is wobbling.
Yeah. There's just a thin skin of vegetation, and underneath that is almost liquid peat. A peat bog is a bit like a malfunctioning compost heap in that normally a compost heap, all the stuff rots down and starts to disappear and reduce. But with a peat bog, because it's waterlogged and acidic, then it just keeps accumulating. It doesn't disappear.
So did you restore this bit, or was this bit conserved?
Well, the Scottish Natural Heritage have been working here since the 1980s to restore the damage to the bog. I mean, for hundreds of years, people have been trying to get rid of the moss. And so the state of the moss was getting worse and worse, and we've now started to sort of turn it around and get it restored back to what it would have been like in former times.
I'm going to ask a heretical question. Why? Why is it important? Why is this waste ground that we can see in front of us important?
These good people have spent hundreds of years clearing it. Why are you putting it back?
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, one is that there's wildlife that you find here that you don't find in hardly any other habitats, and there is very little of this peat bog left. Mm-hmm. But in current times, with climate change happening, then we're actually locking up carbon. There's a huge amount of carbon in the peat here, and by re-wetting the bog, we're actually locking up the carbon, and by getting the process starting again, there's more carbon being locked up. You know, we're trying to sort of mitigate the effects mm-hmm. of climate change here.
No, it has its own form of beauty, you know, but it needs somebody like you, needs somebody with an informed eye to say, this is what you're looking at, this is what's important. It's a bit like looking at the sea. I mean, it is kind of nestled in between the river here and those low hills, but, you know, there's the mountains right absolutely in the background. There was, in history, almost a sort of urban myth that this was the great stopper. This, you know, this could prevent, you know, keep Stirling safe, you know, prevent armies marching through here. Has that got any historical validity at all?
Yes, the myth is that it was peatland that went right the way down the length of the Forth, this western Forth Valley. And that's not actually the case. It was a series of peat bogs that were dotted down the Carse, but there were still ways between them. So the local people, the farmers, single travellers could go north and south across the Forth. But if you had a big army and a whole baggage train, you would have found it difficult. And that's where Stirling became important, because that was the place, one of the only places really that you could take an army going north or going south.
You go to other bogs around about Scotland and almost inevitably at some stage somebody's dug a body out of it, a well-preserved body at some stage. Does Flanders Moss have one?
I don't think so, but we do have whale skeletons.
What?
And also, apparently we have one of the oldest buckets found in the UK as well. One of the most interesting things about the whale skeletons is that some of them were found with axe marks and cut marks on the bones. So I guess that, you know, some people living on the cast at that time must have opened up the curtains or opened up the tent, looked out one morning and found a whale there and thought Christmas had come early. And waste not, want not, and made use of it. And it's interesting because we put in this path and a lot of people laughed at us and said, well, why would anybody want to come and visit a bog?
They are, there's people out on there at the moment.
Yeah, and what we find now is, I mean, people absolutely love it. And they're not necessarily coming to see the specialist wildlife and the specialist insects and things. What they're coming is because it's just a fantastic feeling. It's a bit of ancient landscape. You come out here, you step through the trees away from that commercial farmland, and you're into a different world, and it's a bit of escapism, really. And people just love the feel of it. That's what they often say to me. They just love coming here for the peace and tranquility.
Last time we crossed the river, which was at Aberfoyle, that's the first bridge across the River Forth, again, it's quite narrow. This is now 4-5 times wider. Still black, but because the mist is hanging over, you get this sort of, you know, sort of real witchy effect, because the trees are out of focus, the reflection is out of focus. You can see just one spit of land there, and just at the end of the spit of land, there are two fishermen casting at the moment. But again, they're just vague, indistinct. It's almost like a Chinese watercolour painting. It's really quite beautiful here.
It's a bit unnerving, actually, just seeing all these guys, like herons standing at the side of the water.
That's a good description, actually.
It's very, very different.
Yeah.
There's a salmon.
Good evening. This is Scotland.
And through the whole of Scottish history, Stirling is the funnel. If you want to go north, you want to go south, you have to come through Stirling. That's why the castle is there. That's why Stirling is the capital. When the Romans get to Stirling, they describe Scotland north of the Forth as being virtually another island. So throughout Scottish history, anything that happens in Scottish history impacts on Stirling. The Romans, the Jacobites, every army going north or south, there is this physical impact. And the actual control of the crossing points, these are centres of power and influence.
Scotland, the place to be. This is Scotland.
Scotland,
Scotland,
Scotland.
Scotland.
This is day two. We've arrived here beside the M9. You can actually hear the traffic in the background. The Forth here is twice the size of where we actually crossed it on the first bridge.
Suddenly got kind of, it's a big river, but it's still slow, it's still far. Right. And I don't know if you know it, just outside Stirling, there's a very distinctive bridge with kind of armour-plated spikes on it. It looks like something you would cross in East Germany for. But a lot of fishermen here at the moment as well.
Yeah, indeed, and John Hunter's one of them. We met you before at Kenmore.
Kenmore, that's correct.
So, is this a productive river?
It's a very productive river. It was one of the best rivers in Scotland about 3-4 years ago. Yeah. The amount of salmon comes off, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And the bridge is a pipeline bridge. It's water that goes across the light, and it's, we've got it opened up so we can get across it. Yeah.
And how lucky have you been in the river?
I've had 18 salmon and 8 to 10 sea trout this year.
This year, aye.
I've done really well, aye.
Yeah. Well, just before we started recording, we were chatting to you and you were saying, you know, it's Hotchamus salmon at the moment. There's one there. Just leapt out the water. It's just incredible.
There are quite a lot of wee salmon about the new called Grills, 3 to 5 pounds. And they were too big in Scott just for it here on Saturday morning.
Now, just what we're talking about the fishermen, Scott Mason is a fisheries manager here. Obviously, a productive stretch of river.
It is, yeah. 2010, we were the best beat in the full of Scotland.
Uh-huh.
So, for a local authority-owned river, that's pretty good going, like you. We're one of the last local authority-owned rivers in Scotland, so we hold ourselves quite, we're quite special.
There's one just right out of the water just now. But why is this particular bit so productive? What makes it special?
This is one of the first holding pools from the fish coming from the tidal reaches. So the fish come up from Kincardine, swim up past South Alloa, fill in the mucky waters, they try and bomb through there as quick as they can.
Did you say the mucky waters?
Yeah, very dirty, aye. Because the Forth meanders quite a lot. The tides, when the tides push in and out, the water, the muck can't get away.
It kind of churns.
It does, aye. And if you drive down to places like South Alloa and Kincardine, you'll see the mucky flats. The muck can't get away because it meanders so much. So the fish try to bomb through that as quick as they can, and they get up to places like here. The first stopping point for them is a bit just downstream from here, about maybe half a mile at the back of Cottonvale Prison called the Piers. So the fish start to hold up there, and we've got the mouth of the island down there as well, the River Allen, where the fish for the island will hang about deciding what way they want to go. And then the teeth fish will come up here and they'll hang about here. Because there's not a lot of water in the river just now, they won't be too fussed about migrating upstream too fast.
Why are they jumping out of the water? Because they have a dim memory of they don't eat when they get in fresh water. What are they doing?
There'll be a lot of fish in here which are resident fish which have came in, and because we've had low water for a while, they've been hanging about here for quite a few weeks. These fish will just be playing, basically, just keeping their shell fit. And other fish which come in fresh off the tide, you'll see them, they're absolute bars of silver. They're jumping about trying to get sea lice off them.
So basically the impact of them hitting the surface of the water again theoretically will knock the sea lice off.
That's what they're trying to do, yeah. So they say that coming into fresh water, if you've got lice on your fish, it's been in fresh water for a maximum of something like 48 hours. So the fish, if you see a bar of silver in here jumping about, there's every chance it's just came fresh and off a tide.
How special is this river to you? Do you get any sense of bonding with it? Is it a special place for you?
Yeah, I've fished, I stay in Stirling, I've fished this river and the River Teith all my life. So for me to be fisheries manager on something that I love doing...
You want to watch, basically.
Basically, aye. If I'm not here working, I'm down here fishing. So I can't really complain like you. So aye, it's not like you go to work every day. It's like you go and do your hobby every day. So
another aspect of this river is its history, and to a certain extent its geography, you know, what it physically does. Murray Cook is a county archaeologist in this area. To a large extent, this was a barrier historically.
There's a couple of places you can walk dry shod in summer at low tide, but it's quite hard. If you go that way to Flanders Moss, the Fords of Frew, small-scale armies can get through the Fords of Frew. We know Bonnie Prince Charlie did this in 46 because the army blew up Stirling Bridge to stop them getting north just ahead of Culloden. But the actual formal fords, so at Cambus Kenneth, there is a ford and a causeway for pedestrian traffic and a ford for kind of horses. And we were digging there just the other week and we found Robert II coin, medieval horseshoes. But on the other side, where the river is slightly deeper, there's a harbour. There isn't a ford, you have to catch a boat to get across. So where we are now, yes, there's the dikes, but that barrier there, you actually have to get a boat across here.
How busy would this have been in terms of a trade? You know, because it's a barrier in one way, but it's also, you know, an arterial route in another. But, you know, boats would have been coming right up into Stirling itself.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no. There's, I mean, Stirling is a harbour. The Cambus Kenneth Ford, which is called the Abbott's Ford, had to be blown up by one of the Stevensons in the middle of the 19th century to ensure that larger boats could actually get to Stirling. So by the 18th and 19th century, the harbour is already falling because the scale of the boats are actually too big to allow passage. But there's another ford at Kildene. I've seen it a couple of times, but in 1978, somebody fishing found a human jaw there and they had it on their bookshelf for 30 years. I got it about 6 months ago and we got it dated. It's 1000 BC, the jaw.
1000 BC?
BC. This human jaw now...
Over 3,000 years
yes,
old then?
And it just lying at this ford in the Forth, fishermen going across. We don't know where it came from, because it might have come from further up, or it might have been in the ford. But next year, low tide, we're going to go back. We're going to get some metal detectors out and actually metal detect the ford. And because this is Cambus Kenneth, and, you know, this Cambus Kenneth, the bend of Kenneth, this might be Kenneth McAlpin. We certainly know that ford's used by Robert the Bruce. We know it's used by James III, James IV, Mary Queen of Scots. There is a 9th century logboat that was found at Cambus Kenneth, which is still in the tower, which will be used by monks for getting across. But actually, the royal barges, because of this royal funeral that takes place there, this is, you know, literally in the footsteps of kings.
When we put out this request on Facebook, asking for ideas of things we could do on the River Forth, one of the groups that got back in contact with us was Stirling Ranger Service. And I think, Claire Bird, I mean, that was you who got in contact?
Yeah, that was me who got back in touch with me, yeah. On a good day from up here, though it's thick with mist today, you can actually see across the Stirling Castle. You can see the Wallace Monument ahead and Damyet, which was a hill fort historically. And beautiful views across the Carse. Lots of lovely meadows in front of us. House martins and swallows at the right time of year scooting about. Today, well, it's misty, so we've got a completely different atmosphere.
Because this is tidal, how does that affect how, you know, the variety of species that you actually get here?
It increases them. Obviously, we've got fresh water in the river already coming downstream from Ben Lomond and beyond. And you've got other waters joining in. We've got the Teith that joins in, the Forth just north of us. We've got the Allen joining in just south of us at the moment. It's a lot of nice fresh water coming in from a variety of areas. And you've also got the salt water coming upstream. And the fish follow that salt water. Scott's already told you about the salmon. We get sea trout coming up as well. And then, obviously, you get the things that predate on these. So we've got otters, possible sightings occasionally of porpoises, seals. There are cormorants. So, it's a really big and healthy, vigorous wildlife that you can get down here.
What about dolphins?
Occasionally dolphins, possibly. I haven't seen one myself, but I'm sure there are people in Stirling who have.
And presumably, you know, what we were talking earlier about, the sort of, you know, the mucky areas. You know, if there's that amount of sediment kicking about, worms, I mean, if you got stuff living in the mud, you've got stuff that predates on the worms as well.
Yes, yeah, I mean, we've got lots of good wading birds that you'll see down on the flats and things, and down, you know, you drive through Stirling and you think it's a lovely river city, which it is, but then you get some of the areas at low tide and all you can see down the edges of the river are 2 or 3 metres of exposed mud. And in the right times of year, when the tide is low, yes, you'll get a good healthy wading bird population down there, feeding on all, as you say, all the worms and vertebrates and things that are down in amongst the mud. And because we are at the very tidal reaches, the salinity of the water doesn't increase a massive amount. But you do get, I mean, we get flounders and things coming up the river as well, which I think is fantastic. We did a survey a couple of years ago of a drainage ditch in the middle of a field. Uh-huh. They were going to be doing some work. And we found a flounder, which was probably no bigger than my thumbnail.
Yeah.
But was there and in the ditch off the side of the river.
Looking very confused.
Yeah, a bit confused. And this was down below the Wallace Monument.
Underpinning this entire programme is the River Forth. You know, if you go up Damyet or onto the, just anywhere onto the Ockles, you get the view down onto Stirling, and what becomes immediately apparent is how serpentine it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's oxbow after oxbow after, you know, this is not a river in a hurry.
No, it's a beautifully slow river. When Scott was saying earlier on about the muckiness of it, and that's what helps to create all these amazing bends and slow the river down. There's a lot of farmland either side. But yeah, from the Wallace Monument or any high vantage point over Stirling, you can just see a beautifully snaking river.
It's not often I get a chance to throw some trivia in, but Damyet, overlooking the town, was where Robert Louis Stevenson spent a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And he based Treasure Island on Damyet. The features that are on Damyet crop up in Treasure Island. That is Treasure Island up there. It's incredible.
We also have Stevenson's Cave up just north of Bridge of Allen, where was also featured in Treasure Island.
Yeah. See, she's back.
And Murray's nodding. He's still here. You agree with this?
Oh, do I? Absolutely, yes. No. Stirling is where everything takes place. You know, any event in Scottish history.
Struggle my way up the hill and try and get past the brambles. Yvonne Bowles is from the RSPB. This is the Black Devon Wetlands. Now, we've got the Forth in front of us, which is very muddy, but just above standing, we've got a wee bit of height here. Explain to me what we're looking at there.
So we're on the riverbank that separates the track leading to the landfill site. And just on the other side, we have the Black Devon Wetlands. The wetlands were created in the late 90s through using the clay and the mud to cap the landfill site just at the end of the track, and they were designed to have wildlife in mind, so lots of edges, quite shallow in areas and scrapes to create the great wildlife habitat that you see now.
It's not the prettiest thing in the world, is it?
No, it's not. And we've been looking at this site for a number of years, Ewan, and we managed to get the lease in June of this year for 21 years, basically because the site hasn't been managed in any way for the last 15 years or so. And over that time, the grass has become very, very rank. The reeds have encroached onto the wetlands themselves. And so the whole site needs to be managed and opened up so that people can see the wildlife and that more wildlife, more species of birds can use the different habitats that we can hopefully create in the future.
How are you going to manage it, though? I mean, how are you going to open that up?
We're in discussion with Scottish Wildlife Trust to use their roaming herd of cattle that we can bring them in and graze some areas for longer, for shorter periods of time, and move them around the site. And then we also hope to get local graziers interested in the site as well to come in and graze the land.
So you're going to have a lot of wetlands, pools. It reminds me, looking at it, like, I don't know if I've been to Minsmere in Suffolk, the great RSPB Nature Reserve, avocets, all kinds of wildlife, marsh harriers just screaming over the top there. And it is a bit like that.
It is, on a miniature scale, it is. And that's the great thing of why we were so interested in this site, is that it's one of a network of sites on the Forth, that freshwater habitats and saltwater lagoons, is that hopefully, sometime in the future, we will have enough reed beds throughout the landscape that may attract marsh harriers. We know they're just up breeding in the Tay reed beds to the north, so there's no reason, and when we have had sightings here, there's no reason that they won't stop here as well. We've had reports of bearded tits on Tullibody Inch, just up the river a
That's
little
a
way.
That's a bonny wee bird,
I know,
that,
it's
isn't
what
it?
It's my favourite bird.
Is it?
Yes, it is my favourite bird. So who knows what the future holds? Yeah. Who knows?
Is it a difficult thing to sell to the public? Because my initial reaction as I came up here, and I'm 100% wrong, I thought this was just waste derelict land.
Yeah, yeah. And there is some antisocial behaviour associated with that perception, but luckily nothing in the core area. What we have is lots of people, you can see the relationship to Alloa, it's right next door to it. What we have is lots of people coming with their dogs for walks. There's a core path that runs through the site and out through the edge and over the Black Devon and back into a network of paths. And the response that we've had has been amazing, with a number of people wanting to find out more about what we're doing, how they can help, and wanting to volunteer.
Across this other side of the levee, you know, you've got the River Forth itself, and it's an incredibly rich environment too. We've been here in oyster catches and curlews and all sorts of things.
It's just the weirdest landscape, because, you know, we drove through the recycling plant to get here. They've got the massive pylons crossing the Forth at Alloway. A real industrial landscape,
yeah.
And then the drama of the mudflats. It's a real mix.
Yeah, it is. And I guess that you could argue that's what makes the Forth so special, is that you still have managed to hold on to these little wildlife areas amongst this big industrial landscape.
Right from Kidlochard, our experience of the river has been it's been a quiet river. It's been quite slow. And it's not like, it's not a river in a rush. It takes its time.
Yeah.
We were standing further up, looking down into the water. You know, it's really muddy. You can see soil swelling. You know, it's saturated. There's a lot of material in there.
Yes. Yeah, the sediment load is very high in terms of rivers per se. And obviously that's why this farmland is so rich, is because over time, centuries ago, all of that sediment glowed silt went into the field.
This thought has just crossed by my mind. This is Scotland's Nile. You know, it's like the Nile Delta. It's that sort of, that's where the fertility is coming from. You know, it's coming from the river itself.
It's quite like the Nile in places as well. But what gets me is, you know, we do have this industrial landscape, and presumably at one time this is a heavily polluted river. But as we came down, we were greeted by the call of the curlew. There's a heron just up the
another
the
one over there.
And just teeming with seabirds. It looks to me like quite a healthy wildlife resource now.
It is, and it is a special protection area, you know, one of an internationally designated site, which is why RSPB are so greatly interested in this area. With the historic uses of the Forth has been very industrial, and it has been heavily polluted. What you'd notice with some of the towns and villages along the Forth have turned their backs on the Forth. But what has been happening over the years is, with climate change and coastal squeeze, some of the really important habitat of salt marsh, which is critical to that part of the intertidal habitats of mud and salt marsh, is being slightly eroded over time because the sea level is increasing. And so what you may see in the next 200-300 years could be something quite different.
Well, I haven't even got out of breath yet, and that must be all of about, what, 300 yards from the car park?
Pretty much.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. We're basically at one end of the Kincardine Bridge, underneath these enormous pylons.
It's quite massive when you get underneath it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day, it's still a bit hazy, but it's just, it's warm. Mm-hmm. Perfect day for a cycle.
Well, we're on the Fife Coastal Path. Theoretically, it's 4 miles to Kooros. We're now very much in the sort of industrial heartland of Scotland. You know, there's cooling chimneys and towers and, you know, evidence of activity all over the place.
Still very much a country feel to it. I mean, there's traffic all the time and there's all these massive industrial structures, but, you know, lots and lots of little patches of waste ground and bees buzzing over the tansies there. It's lovely.
Couple of good ones. Big. It's always the juicy ones that actually fall off onto the undergrowth.
Well, the good ones always on the other side of the fence.
I don't know.
They're lovely, aren't they?
Yeah, they're excellent. Lovely brambles.
Brambles have been just really, really good at this time of year.
Yeah. Where are you sat at the top of the hill?
Well, I saw it as we came down, and it looks like a field of roses. There's pinks and yellows,
beach,
and red. Right. Absolutely beautiful.
Oh, it is lovely. It must be commercial rose growing because there's huge amounts. Yeah.
I know we've said it before. But it's such a contrast. I've got brambles here, brilliant sunshine in a field, and all around us, this whole wirescape coming out of the power station at Longannet.
Huge pylons, and they're leading back to Longannet itself. Two big towers there, cooling towers, smoke, sodium lights, even during the day. You know, I mean, it looks like something out of a Batman movie, that.
And alarmingly, there was a siren went off just as we went past it, getting a little bit jumpy for a while.
Yeah.
But there is something beautiful, the way the light catches those insulators and the wires.
Yeah.
It's almost like spider gossamer, isn't it?
Very similar. Very, you know, and it's an easy comparison to make at this time of year because the spider web's just all over the shop.
But what's been great so far, it is early days, and it's pretty much a cycle track the whole way so far.
Off-road.
Which is terrific, because I do feel jumpy on a proper main road. Mm-hmm. And getting off the road on this, just loving it so far.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Cracker.
Pick me some roses.
You remember that, I can't remember what story I was doing, but I pulled on the handbrake in a certain way and folk were phoning in and saying, you know, Mark's doing that all wrong.
You were on the Western Isles and somebody thought it was a corn creek.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but I'm convinced that listening to these bicycles, folk are going to be sort of writing in and saying, there's a problem with Mark's bottom bracket. Now, how true those words are?
Absolutely. I tell you, I'm enjoying, absolutely savouring his working gears for the first time in my life.
Yeah. We're just coming out to Kooros at the moment, and it is just beautiful.
It's a really weird trail of smoke out there. See to the right?
Ah.
Going right up.
I don't think it is a trail of smoke. I think it's a shadow. Look, what you're looking at.
Let's just stop here, because it's
really weird.
Phenomenal. It's the shadow.
It's the shadow of a contrail. And it looks like the trail of smoke.
Right, because there's an aircraft going above us. The sun's directly behind it, and it's cast a shadow. I've never seen that before. But it is the weirdest landscape, isn't it? It's almost lunar. This bit we're coming up just now, the tide's out, and you just got these isolated boats.
Why is there a French flag at the end of this pier?
So many questions, so few answers.
I know. See that hummock out there?
Hang on. We've got an information board. We might well get an answer.
Right, we're laughing. Let's just have a stop and have a shifty at this. Because I think there's the entrance to a coal pit somewhere around about here. The moat pit.
The moat pit.
Look for a large heap of stones out in the bay at low tide. That.
Yeah.
400 years ago, you'd have seen a large circular stone tower standing about 16 feet tall. This was the breakwater of a mine shaft sunk by Sir George Bruce. You can't possibly go along this section of the River Forth without coming into Kouros, the National Trust for Scotland property. Linda Whiteford is the...
Senior assistant.
Right. And also our own Bill Whiteford's wife, I think I'm correct in saying.
Well, yes. Currently.
Oh, right, yes. He's still on probation, is he? All right, fair enough.
25 years probation, yeah.
This is a magical place. I've never been here before. I mean, it's my fault. It's just a brilliant wee village.
It glows on a day like today, south-facing, and the palace is just shining out at its best. It's a glorious sort of gingery, ochery colour, and that's all George Bruce's doing. This was his home.
It's got the red pantile roof, too, and... I've never seen one of these trees before. What is this growing in the corner of the courtyard?
It's a gorgeous almond tree.
Almonds?
Yeah.
So whose house was this?
This was the house of Sir George Bruce, who was a descendant of Robert the Bruce. So he came from kind of wealthy stock. But he was a clever guy. He was a nice guy. He knew about engineering. And he took over the mining rights to this area from the monks up the road and basically made his fortune from mining and from making salt.
Was he the one that built the moat pit, that George Bruce?
That George Bruce,
okay, right,
yes.
Fine.
And you'll see the first part of the palace here on your left, if just come in the gate. On the left, with the first part of the palace, built in 1597, and he's got GB above one of the windows there. And the other part, facing you, SGB above the window, because he was knighted in 1611. S. Sir George Bruce. None of this putting your wife's initials up or anything.
Forget that. No. I tell you, one thing that immediately strikes me at 6'1" is that it was basically built for somebody like you.
It's about proper door heights for real people.
It's real people.
I'm sure it's your garden.
Ah.
There's an offer. Yeah, oh, can't refuse.
Come on. We'll have a shifty.
At night time, this garden really comes alive as well. All the wonderful smells from the roses and the flowers and the herbs. It's a great garden to scratch and sniff.
It is. When we've walked into a stand of, what is this, fennel here?
Yes.
You've got teasels. Yep. It's a real architectural garden. There's wonderful shapes at this time of year.
You can date everything back here to about the 1650s. Uh-huh. It's laid out in that kind of fashion. Everything has a use for lotions, potions or poisons. Uh-huh. And everything. I mean, you think it's a weed. It's not. It's probably something that will save your life one day.
There's a great wee seat up the back here.
Oh, we'll head up to this wee seat. Go on. Get into the sunshine.
And even these seeds are fantastic. You can squeeze them and smell the fennel. Give them a squeeze and you'll get some.
Oh, yeah. That's almost a sort of aniseedy
smell,
isn't it?
Aniseedy, yes.
Yeah. And you've got white shell on the top. You know, on a sunny day like today.
But the calcium goes back into the ground. Mm-hmm. I just realised this the other day. You learn something new every day here. And even though they're all getting crushed down, there's a purpose because it'll feed the soil.
I'm just eating one of your apples.
Get some more.
Where did you get that from?
Smashing a tree.
I found it.
Dude, it's wonderfully unstructured, if that's the correct word. You know, it's got a real... We say cottage garden, but it's really condensed and cluttered and thistles.
Well, we let everything grow because we need the teasels to put on the seats in the palace because it stops people sitting on the seats,
seriously?
You see. Absolutely. They used to use them for carding wool but and other things, but they might be a pest to some folk, but to us they're absolutely valuable. And you can spray them and make lovely dried flower displays with them. So
Christmas decorations.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You've got all these potions and plants and poisons. It kind of strongly suggests connections with witchcraft.
Oh, yes, yes. Like a lot of towns around here, Kouros was quite famous for its witch trials and the superstition that went around. It's the best way of getting rid of anybody you didn't like, really. You could just accuse them of being a witch. Very simple. They'd be taken away to the courtroom and judged. Say, all right, okay, we'll see if she or he was guilty, and they would carry out a series of torture procedures, basically, and your family would have to pay for that to be done as well. That's a great way of extorting money out of folk. George Bruce was a very good friend of King James the First and Sixth, and of course he wrote a book, famous book about hunting witches called Demonology, and there are even marks around the fireplace in the laird's room which were supposed to prevent witches coming down the chimney.
No, I mean, it's extraordinary thinking about it, back in like nowadays, but you know, just along the coast there, I mean, women were burned alive in barrels of tar and things like that. I mean, it's just extraordinarily brutal. But
oh,
you know.
Yeah. And we boys would be getting their lugs pinned to the pillory here just for...
Nailed, for not looking. Pinned, nailed to the post, yeah.
Pinned hard. And yeah. The only way you'd get out of it was to have your ear ripped off or to rip it off yourself.
Yeah. Cheery, eh?
Yeah.
Cheery. I tell you what, this is a phenomenal sun trap. You know, here we are, well into autumn, and it's just boiling hot.
This is us come up onto the top terrace because I wanted a closer look at this. I mean, that is probably one of the most productive espaliered apple trees I've ever seen in my life. That's extraordinary.
It's loving the heat. And, of course, yeah. The big sandstone walls, the high sandstone walls, just radiate that heat, soaks it in and puts it out there. Yeah. And that's why we can grow things like these apples and the grapes. We've got peaches, we've got apricots. We've got all sorts of kind of exotic things here. Yeah. Medlars, mulberries. Yeah.
You name it, you've got it here.
Yeah.
And you also get a fantastic view looking down over this garden. And this is possibly the best position.
Well,
right the way across the Forth, look at that.
We can go even higher.
Really?
George Bruce was a clever guy. He wanted to see what ships were coming up and down the Forth. So if the highest point of the garden, you're actually higher than the palace. And you can see if there's any privateers coming up and down or see if your ship's coming in. Where the road is now, where you cycled in, was actually the harbour. Mm-hmm. They filled that in, we think, in about the 1920s, 30s. I'm not sure about that. But they filled it in to make a railway. And but otherwise, the harbour was basically at his front door.
Yeah.
And so all the ships would come and berth there.
We were saying, just when we were down on the riverfront there, what a glorious day this is, and the fact that it feels so Mediterranean.
Yes.
And now you're amongst all those sort of rosemary and lavender and everything else, and it just, this is so beautiful.
Isn't it? You can see for miles. You really can. What a clever, clever design. George Bruce was a very canny man. He could see right over the top of the palace for miles up and down the Forth because the ships would have been coming and going. The place was a hive of activity. There was tanners, there were blacksmiths, there was a bakery, there was all sorts of things going on. The place would be absolutely stinking.
Yeah.
But it was a very prosperous place and he could see it all from up here.
Is it a common reaction? Is that we just coming up there? I could sense the smile coming on.
Yes.
And I was looking around me just now, everybody's smiling. Is that a common reaction?
Absolutely. It's something about this garden that just makes everybody go, and smile. And how could you not smile when you see the views, all the birds flying past? You can hear our hens in the orchard there, our wee breed of Scots dumpy hens. Tough as old boots, they live in the trees at night as well, all year round. But you're looking across to Bowness and down to Grangemouth and it's all about the past. It's like the past meeting the future because this place was built on coal and salt and one man's kind of dream and looking after his workers as well and make sure that they were all right. Here we are again, sort of looking out at Grangemouth. Long Annet's up the road there. It's all kind of tied in. Great.
But you get the sense of, I don't know where you're getting this, it's not a river anymore. It's now a big, massive thing. It's kind of river dissolving into the sea almost now.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And you know what? We can see, when the tide goes way out, as it was earlier on today, you can see the moat pit, which was what George Bruce was famous for. He brought this idea of an Egyptian wheel back, whereby you had horses instead of camels attached to posts, going round and round and round, a big circle, pulling up a chainload of buckets. Instead of one man, one bucket going down the mine, he was pulling up water and he was pulling up coal and he was doing it four times more efficiently than the monks ever were. And he went a mile out underwater. They reckon it was the world's first underwater mine. And he made this moat pit on land. They had a moat pit just offshore on a wee islet. Mm-hmm. And that was a ventilation shaft he could get down. He actually took James the VI out with him once. Took him down the mine, out, and came up in the water. And James the VI shouted, "Treason, treason!" Because he thought he was being drowned. He just couldn't get it in his head how he'd managed to get underwater and come up.
That's deadly nightshade, leave that.
It's pretty though, isn't it?
Yes, it's pretty.
It's like a massive, shiny blaebery. Yeah.
I know it's past time for your accident on this trip, but let's not go down that route. Linda, could we possibly nick a couple of apples? I mean, those look fantastic.
Oh,
these are
just don't climb the bush.
Can you get two?
I'll not tell the boss.
They are the most gorgeous looking apples. They look quite, I'm no expert, they look quite a,
there is
a variety. I've never seen it in the flesh.
Called Bloody Ploughman, and I wonder if this is it.
Oh, one just fell off.
That behind me,
they look like an old variety, don't they?
Yeah.
You take that for your picnic on your journey.
We'll try it now, or you want to try it later? I think we'll try it now. I can't actually wait. Oh!
Wow!
That has got to be Bloody Ploughman.
Your teeth have come out.
That's like opening a tomato. It is
bright pink on the inside. And what a surprise that was!
And it's bleeding. Mm. There's veins of red, and it's slowly changing from white to red. Like a pomegranate almost.
That is brilliant.
Is it nice?
Yeah.
It's actually stomping. You want a bite?
Go on. Yeah. All right. Oh, that's lovely.
If it doesn't bleed, you're a witch.
Right, let's hit the road. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You're very welcome.
Quick bite of lunch and I'm back on the track again.
But the tide's come in a lot and the whole character's changed. The mud flats have gone. All that peat from further up the river is now covered over, and it's transformed it a bit. It's more like a big loch now.
Yeah, it has that feel about it. You know, if you didn't know it was a river, you know, you might be fooled into thinking that. But we're heading along the track here. Keep your eyes open because there's a party here of walkers led by the appropriately named Sue Walker. But they said they would be here this afternoon. But quite where we meet them, because we're running behind schedule now, I don't know.
Still managed to find time for the scone stop.
Well, that's true. This entire programme is fuelled by scones. Cannot work unless the scone is forthcoming.
Okay. This is lovely, thank you. We're having a grand time.
Hello. We're caught up with Sue Walker from the Inner Forth Landscape Initiative. The party that you were leading has done the right thing and abandoned you completely. They wandered off. You're probably going to have to sprint after them at some stage. The group that you were taking out, what's the point of that? Why are you taking them out?
We've walked from Lime Kilns and we're heading all the way to Kincardine on this 11-mile stretch of the Fife Coast Path. And we've seen some fantastic things. We've seen Torrey Bay, which is part of the fourth Ramsar site. That means it's of global importance. Mm-hmm. You know, we have something on our doorstep that's in global importance for its wildlife. And people need to know about that and understand it. And it's also just beautiful on a day like this. We were sitting having our lunch and we've got this huge expanse of mud flats. It was full of curlew, of widgeon, geese flying by. You know, it was a soundscape as well as what it looked like. And it was just gorgeous, and especially on a day like today. We want to just remind people of that and say, come out, enjoy it. You can walk, you can cycle. There's all sorts of ways of getting here. You can just sit in a picnic table and look out over the Forth and have a great time.
Is that message getting out there? I mean, is it starting to work? Because earlier we were speaking to somebody who said there was a tendency for people to turn their back on the river because it was an eyesore, it was unpleasant, and they looked elsewhere and ignored what was behind them. Is that message starting to change? The fact that we've got a fantastic cycle path along the side of the Forth?
I think it is starting to change, and we just need to have that sort of trickle effect. So I think there's still a lot of people, particularly if you live a bit further north in Scotland, you tend to look to the north and the west, where there's the mountains and the coastline, and people don't think about looking to here. But I think the message is getting through, and as more local authorities do stuff, as more organisations such as ourselves are able to do stuff, I think there is more of a feeling. And building up local pride is what it's about, because our best ambassadors are the people who live here. And once they start saying, actually, where I live is really great, you should come and see it, then we've cracked it.
To a certain extent, you know, this started off as obviously a rural area of Scotland, and then with the Industrial Revolution it became an industrialised area of Scotland. With heavy industry in decline, it's healing itself, slowly but surely. I could understand why certain communities, certain towns did turn their back on the river, because, frankly, nobody celebrates a sewer. But it's not a sewer anymore, and it's a fascinating place. It's rich in so many ways.
Absolutely. And yes, it is healing itself. I mean, there are still issues, and we you know that there is still industrial development. We do still have worries about the effects that climate change are going to have in terms of rising sea levels and coastal squeeze, where we're losing all those lovely mud flats and salt marshes. But in terms of local pride, I think that is turning round, and people are seeing that there is absolutely another side to it.
We've just stopped outside a fantastic building called the Witch's Tower. Mark's actually down on the beach, got some geese going overhead. And as you do, he's looking for bricks. What have you found?
Well, they're nice bricks. They're a good heft to them. But there's no names on them.
You can come back up then. But
yeah,
this has been a complete revelation to me. I don't know about you. It is a beautiful path right alongside the waters, big walls. You can see over the wall a proper orchard. Look at the colour of the apples on that one. Bright, bright red.
Fantastic.
It's not just us. Maybe everybody else in the world knows about it. But
well, I don't know. I mean, you see quite a few people walking dogs and things like that, you know, and there have been people having picnics and enjoying the odd ice cream. But this is a resource that could take a lot more traffic. You know, and there haven't been that many cyclists. I mean, yes, we had to do a section there of maybe, what, about a mile on the road. But aside from that, you've been utterly safe. Even you've been utterly safe.
It very much feels like the Solway Firth to a certain extent. Yeah. Is, you know, here we are in the central belt, industrialised Scotland. Yeah. And apart from Grangemouth over there, we could be almost in parts of France. It's just terrific.
Yeah. You can see big industrial cranes across there. Longannet is now in the distance looking up, but again, reflecting in the water. And the water itself is like the sky. It's just this milky blue, and it's pearlescent effect, the sky. Just a really weird quality of light. It's as if everything's been sort of painted with this light blue.
It's got that almost mercurial type of quality to the water.
Yeah. And we were talking to Sue further back, and she was saying, oh, you know, the tide will be in by now, and therefore you won't see the mudflats. There's still heaps of ducks and geese and what have you, but, you know, do you get the impression, too, there's something of a microclimate here, because it's south-facing? I don't know.
Well, it started back at that National Trust property, and it was just really hot. But it's got a real midsummer, almost European feel to it. It's just very, very warm.
Yeah. Under extreme protest, we've actually deviated from the route along the side of the Forth here, and we've doubled back on ourselves. After a fairly up and down section, we had to avoid the MOD.
We've been lulled into a sense of false security because we're going along the coastal path. Flat, calm, flat road, God's in his heaven. And then suddenly there was problems with the sea defences, I think, and it goes way inland. And there's a
up
huge
and
hill,
up
and then suddenly we're drenched in sweat, and as you can hear, we're pecking a wee bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, only slightly. Only
and we're
slightly
back down at sea level again.
And the reason we came here, half a mile back, basically in the wrong direction, is to meet up with Rory McDonald from Historic Scotland. These are magnificent. Tell me what these are.
These are lime kilns. And they are the best preserved, biggest set of lime kilns in Scotland. In fact, maybe in the whole of the UK. They are about, 250 years old, the oldest section. So the kind of section right by where we're standing, where there's the first six holes, oldest section, built by the Earl of Elgin in 1757. At the cost of £12,000 back then. So try and do the maths.
Talk me through what a lime kiln was for. We passed the limestone centre as we came up. What was the function of them?
Well, why don't we cunningly go through the fence, since you're with a Historic Scotland
person? So that's what all the local youth have been doing for a bit of that.
Yes, indeed, but at least we can do it officially. So standing outside the kiln, right above the top, you'll have a big pot or a chimney where all the limestone went in. You'd have coal, limestone.
Okay.
Coal is lit, burns the limestone, and then as it goes down, the next layer of coal is lit and the next layer of limestone goes. And these tiny little openings are where the finished product, where the quicklime comes out. So guys with shovels put them onto hoppers, because we know from archaeological excavations back in the 90s there was a railway tracks out the front here, onto the little hoppers, into the ship, and off you go.
So is that a powder, or is it?
It is a powder, which you then mix with water and various other things, depending what use you want to make of it. And quicklime was used for fertilizer. It was used for mortar to build buildings, but also things like glass making, soap boiling, sugar refining, tarning, a whole host of things.
And what led to the demise of these things?
Essentially, there were no limestone easily to haunt. They actually finished, the last one was fired in 1957.
As late as that?
As late as that. So industrialisation is the other thing, that it was the demise of a lot of these, you know, old traditional industries.
This place must have been coaching with workers and boats and trains and horses.
Must have been like a vision of hell in there.
Yeah.
It would have been like something out of Dante's Inferno. Burning limestone to make quicklime. The quicklime is caustic. If it gets in your eyes, gets in your skin, it burns, gets in your throat, it gives you lung problems. And these things were going 9 months of the year. Not all of them at once, and there's 14 of them. You can imagine the clouds of toxic fumes coming up. And although the workers were quite well off, Lord Elgin built them a village, Charleston, which is up behind the kilns. It must have been a, you know, a dreary place to live.
It's quite interesting from our point of view, because if you're coming down the Forth and looking at industrialisation, looking at the power station, looking at the fractionation towers, that actually to get hands-on with the industrial past, it's quite... It kind of grinds you a wee bit.
Yeah. Oh, it's the fact that, you know, Victorian era was the sort of can-do era. I mean, they were fantastically inventive, they were fantastically creative, fantastically industrious. But it, by and large, it was the cost of human lives. Time after time, it didn't matter what industry it was.
No, it was people. And I think there was a ready supply of labour, so there was a ready supply of bodies. And somewhere like here, it was the only show in town. If you lived in Charleston, then you worked in the kilns. You know, there wasn't much option, really. If you didn't work in the kilns, imagine your family would have starved. Harsh reality.
You could not get a bigger contrast between Kinlochard and this.
It is just awe-inspiring. Right underneath the Forth Rail Bridge, and it's just a mass spider's web of steel.
Such a fantastic piece of engineering. And we've come through, you know, your really heavily industrialised section there. And yet you come down here against probably the finest example of it, and you're back in peace and quiet again. You know, you've got jets coming in overhead to Edinburgh Airport, but aside from that, it's pretty quiet.
I thought this last bit was going to be a doddle, though. I thought it was going to be a dedicated path beside the water, so it was going to be flat, and it was anything but. It's quite a lot of roads. Yeah. Not complaining about it, they're quite quiet roads, but it was certainly in the traffic and a few serious hills.
Yeah, ever since you've got corn flies stuck in the corner of your eyes. I've probably got earthworms stuck in the corner of my teeth.
What happened there?
We decided to take a shortcut across a stubble field, and there was a furrow I wasn't expecting, and my bike just suddenly... Well, the front wheel stopped, and I did what you did.
There's a train going over.
Wow.
It's a great sound. I did what you did at Helensburgh.
You didn't break your arm, though?
No, I wasn't nearly so manly as you. But talking about me and manly... Oh, you've got blood!
Look at that. Look. That's a mosquito bite.
That's never a mosquito bite.
Next...
Yes,
we cycled past it. I don't know what you were thinking.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, it's that red box on the side of that pillar, which is about 600 feet high. It's now officially taller than the Forth Road Bridge. You know, the third crossing across the Forth. That's where we're going tomorrow. You know, is that a lift? I hope it's not a ladder.
I hope it's not a ladder, but it suddenly looks seriously high. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you, I've got a real, real problem with heights.
Yeah.
And you probably couldn't get a worse place to go up.
That's not a train, that's the sound of Ewan's heart.
See that little red thing? There's a little red thing there climbing up, because coming down the tower. That's what you're going to be in there, yeah. It's quite exposed. A little bit jerky when you get to the top.
Well, we're now on the barge next to the actual caisson. You look up.
It's quite difficult looking that far up.
Yeah, well, you're closer to it than I am, but it's still
not by much, relatively speaking.
Columba's a genuine name?
Yes.
How extraordinary. I've never met a Columba before.
St. Columba of Iona.
Ah, well, absolutely.
There we go.
What's your job here? What do you do?
I'm the general foreman here.
General foreman, so you've got to watch everything like a hawk, essentially.
Exactly.
You are an experienced bridge man. You've worked in umpteen around Scotland.
Yeah, in Scotland and throughout the world as well.
How does this compare?
This is unique.
This
is one of a kind. I mean, the size of this bridge, the enormity of this bridge, I don't think we will ever see anything like this in the UK again. I mean, the span between these two columns is exceptional. 650 metres is an exceptional long span for any bridge. I mean, this will be, I think, the second largest span in the world once it's finished.
Okay. Drink.
Now, ideally, when you press that button, the Thunderbirds music would come on at the same time.
I'm not hearing those anymore.
It's quite fast.
Yeah. That's quite fast, but this one's quite slow. I mean, not slow. It's slow. It's slow in time. When we go to Top Alimak, it takes approximately 3 minutes and 45 seconds to get from deck level up to the top of the jump form. So close to 4 minutes.
So it's all quite noisy at the moment. Does it get quieter as you go further up?
No, not at all.
How big's a little jerk?
A little jerk.
Enough to make you feel you might be going down slightly.
Well, thank you for warning us.
Did you hear that?
Something about a little jerk.
There you go.
You know, I'm
tried
so,
to warn you.
So glad you warned me. It's so undignified when I scream. On to the very top.
Oh, this is brilliant.
Here we are.
This is absolutely superb. Alan, this is like all my birthdays have come at once. We're above the level of the rail bridge, we're above the level of the fourth bridge. We've got the fourth running that direction. You can see right the way across Edinburgh, all the way up the other side, you know, upstream of the fourth, across to Fife. This has got, I mean, unless you're on a plane, this is now officially the best view of the Central Belt.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're one of the lucky people who's been up here.
Yeah.
Don't think we don't. We love it.
Do you still get a belt out of it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what a job to have. You can come outside on a lovely day like today and have a good look round.
We are being spoiled, though. In a heavy wind, this must be a different place.
It's pretty horrible up here. In the rain and the wind, it's pretty rotten.
Yeah. I was asking Columba on the way up here, do you get frightened by heights? And he says, no, not at all. None of these guys can be.
Well, I have a healthy respect for them.
Yeah.
Because I think if there isn't an element of fright there, you become blasé about what's going on. There's guys working underneath us at 50 metres level, and there's guys working on the barge at zero. So if you drop something from here, even a small thing could kill you.
Yeah, I don't know, how wide is this? It's about 30 feet across.
It's about 30 feet across, 20 foot the other way. And
straight up many hundreds of metres from the sea.
Yep.
We'd be what about? What are you sniffing?
I know, we're sniffing. Nervous.
What we're looking at here is just the outside of the tower.
Yes, that's right.
So if the outside of the tower is on the inside of us, what are we standing on?
We're standing basically in the thin air on a platform on the outside of the tower.
Yeah, I just mentioned that to cheer you and up. That's all.
Actually, suddenly realised.
Sniff.
I've worked on bridges now for over 20 years, and to me, it's just the ultimate thing to build. You're building something for the community. You're also building something normally that's quite aesthetically pleasing and interesting for the area.
Can I give you a hand?
Aye, pass me up that, you can see you worked on it.
My turn. Right, there you go. I helped build the fourth bridge. There you go. From the top of the tower here, you know, you'd think this was the most exposed position you could possibly be in, but you'd be wrong, because running up the side of the tower is one of these very slender, but no doubt very strong, yellow cranes. You know, and the crane driver's up there, and between the tower and the crane, there is this walkway, and it must be 600 feet above the surface of the river here, Columba.
Yes, we are more than 600 feet above the river.
That's got to be the loneliest walk to work in Scotland.
For the crane operators, it is an easy walk. Rather than have to climb 160 metres every day up and down, they're quite prepared to go there. And it's all been tested and proved. I've been out myself many a time, but it has all been passed off.
And would they have climbed from the bottom in the past?
Yes, from the past, yeah. Sometimes when we're climbing the crane, we cannot get our bracket onto the access there, so they have to climb it for maybe a week or so until we have access to put the bracket back on again.
They must be right fed up when that happens.
Yeah, really. It takes them a good, 40 minutes, 45 minutes then they get up there, and then they have to have a cup of tea or coffee to revive themselves, shall we say.
So they've got a kettle up there?
They have a kettle, a fridge, microwave, oven.
toilet?
Not a toilet, but
we
have a toilet down here for them.
Oh, there's a toilet
so
here.
They can only have to climb down here and use the bathroom in here.
And I'm not being critical, but it is the most ridiculous sign in the world. There is a barrier across here saying access for crane driver only. Who else in their right mind would want to do that?
You'd be surprised the amount of people we get up here who want to go out there and have a wee look.
I would.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I would. I know we're not allowed to, so I'm safe saying that.
But
I mean, genuinely, I would.
Yeah. I would.
Would
as well.
You like to?
Yeah.
I can give you the authorisation to go out there if you want.
You sure?
I can go out along as long as I come out with you. If you're walling off, then I'll
yeah,
take you out.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Okay.
I'm breaking in a cold sweat thinking
about it.
You
can come out as well.
I'm not coming.
You sure?
Yep.
There we go.
Okay. Right, so we've opened the wee door. Just the wee gate, and what we're doing is stepping out onto this walkway across. And literally, there ain't nothing between us.
Goodness me. Okay. He is 600 feet above the sea with nothing but a plain aluminium ladder between him and a rather bumpy, wet end in the River Forth. And he's loving it. I feel like a bit of a goose now.
It's rock steady, Eddie. No bother at all.
Yeah, you're going to shame me into this, aren't you?
I honestly think you will kick yourself if you don't do it.
Okay, we're not going to go far, but we're going to go and do it.
All right.
All right, stepping out. Wow. This is a stupid thing I've done for a long time. That's far enough. But I'm glad I've done it. I mean, this has got to be the best view in Scotland.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular, isn't it? There's not many people who'll get this kind of view.
Wow. And I hate it when Mark shames me into doing something I'm scared to do.
But at least you can see you've done it now anyway.
Uh-huh. No,
it wasn't just Mark that done it, you've done it as well.
It is brilliant.
Yeah. This has been such a brilliant conclusion, you know, to a trip down the Forth. And essentially, all the ideas that were sent in to us, you know, after that Facebook appeal, we've only been able to cover the North Shore. So there's a heap of stuff on the south side there, heading up the Grangemouth side, the Bowness side, everything else, back up to where we actually started. Still to look forward to, and we will be coming back to that. From you and myself, everybody here at the Forth River Crossing, who've made us so welcome and helped us up this high, much against Ewan's better judgment.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.